Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kathy Kelly of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who describes the suffering she witnessed during a recent fact-finding trip to Afghanistan and explains why she advocates a rapid withdrawal of American forces from that war-ravaged nation. Susan Nossel, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, who summarizes her group's new report documenting the Syrian government's systematic use of torture against opponents of the regime. And Kambali Musavuli, National Spokesperson with the group Friends of the Congo, who takes a critical look at the viral video Kony 2012 that advocates military intervention to deal with the crimes of warlord Joseph Kony. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On the 53rd anniversary of the failed Tibetan uprising against Chinese rule, 18-year-old Buddhist monk Jepe set himself on fire in the town of Aba, an area of frequent anti-Beijing protests, now under a security clampdown. Over the last year, 25 Tibetans, mostly young and educated, have immolated themselves in public places protesting Chinese repression of Tibetan culture and religion. Jepe is the 26th. Chinese officials routinely dismiss the self-immolations as acts of criminals. Until recently, such acts of protest were rare in Tibet, in contrast to the practice of Vietnamese Buddhists. The first self-immolation occurred on March 20, 2011, at the Kirti Monastery. In response, riot police stormed the monastery buildings and police set up 24-hour patrols in the area. Still, self-immolations have continued to spread to other monasteries. But in the face of these protests, Tibetan poet Tsering Wosa, under house arrest in Beijing along with other intellectuals from Tibet, released a call for an end to self-immolations. The statement declared, "Regardless of the magnitude of repression, our life is important and we have to cherish it. Self-immolation in itself cannot change our reality." In anticipation of Pope Benedict's upcoming two-day visit to Cuba, 13 dissidents occupied a Catholic church in Havana. The protesters wanted a meeting with the Pope to discuss their demand for the release of political prisoners held by Cuba's communist government. Over the last 15 years, the Catholic Church in Cuba has emerged as an influential player linking Cuba to the international community while working to promote human rights within the island nation. Catholic authorities helped win the release of 115 political prisoners last year and partnered with Raúl Castro's government to set up an education program for Cuban entrepreneurs at a Spanish university. Cuban Catholic spokesman Orlando Marquez blasted the occupiers, saying, "Nobody has the right to disturb the celebratory spirit of faithful Cubans." The dissidents were arrested 2 days after the protest began. The Castro government plans on extending a warm welcome to Pope Benedict when he arrives on March 26th, including the sprucing up of Revolution Square in Havana, the site of a planned open-air mass. The Cuban government has recently allowed the Catholic Church to set up several websites and print publications reaching over 250,000 people. Cuba watchers do not expect Pope Benedict to make any waves during his visit. The trip is seen as a reward for the new partnership between the Catholic Church and the Castro government, a relationship both sides want to build on. On March 1st, David and Charles Koch, funders of many right-wing groups, filed a suit in Kansas to take control of the Cato Institute, an established libertarian think tank whose mission is to defend free markets, individual liberty, and peace. The suit over the organization's shareholder group is fiercely opposed by current Cato chairman Robert Levy and many longtime Cato scholars and funders. Through its 35-year history, Cato has stayed nonpartisan in promoting its ideas of small government, a non-interventionist foreign policy, and a strong defense of civil liberties, including opposition to the Patriot Act. Top Cato executives say the Koch brothers want to turn the libertarian think tank into another cog in the right-wing attack machine and to undertake research for the benefit of other Koch political groups such as Americans for Prosperity. In 1976, Charles Koch, a founder of the Cato Institute, was one of four people given stock in the new think tank. His brother, David Koch, also became an early supporter and a stockholder, giving the Koch brothers control of half the shares. The brothers have moved to take total control after the death last October of shareholder William Niskanen, Cato's longtime chairman. Several liberal commentators, including Ezra Klein of The Washington Post, have defended the Cato Institute's policy integrity in contrast to the more partisan agenda of the conservative Heritage Foundation. out on the left, Counterpunch, insists Cato is already compromised because board members have strong ties and make large contributions to Republican causes. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The most recent flashpoint for violence in Afghanistan came after U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Robert Bales allegedly shot and killed 9 children, 4 men and 3 women, all civilians, on March 11th in 2 villages near his army base in Kandahar province. The shootings followed violent protests provoked by the late February burning of copies of the Quran and other Islamic religious material by U.S. military personnel at America's Bagram Air Base. Earlier, a video showing 4 U.S. Marines urinating on 3 slain Taliban fighters had provoked angry demonstrations. Together, these incidents have generated outrage on the part of many ordinary Afghan citizens, stoking resentment of what many there believe to be more than 10 years of oppressive U.S. occupation. One indicator of that resentment is the fact that of the 60 coalition troops who have died in Afghanistan since January, 13 have been killed by members of the U.S. allied Afghan security forces. The Obama administration's current plan calls for the withdrawal of 23,000 U.S. troops by the end of September and a complete withdrawal by December 2014, when Afghan forces are expected to take charge of the country's security. Your reporter spoke with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kelly describes the suffering she witnessed during a recent fact-finding trip to Afghanistan and explains why she advocates a rapid withdrawal of American forces from that war-ravaged nation.
Because of the war, many people are displaced, and they have nowhere to go. There are 400 new refugees every day arriving in cities like Kabul. And so you've got huge, sprawling refugee camps where, in the extremely cold winter, it's the harshest winter on record in Afghanistan since anybody's ever been, you know, measuring temperatures. In this extreme cold, people who don't have income, they don't have jobs, they can't afford to buy lumber so that they could light a fire, so that they could have some source of heat in the very makeshift mud huts that people construct for themselves. And so just in the time since January 1st, in the one refugee camp that I've visited most often, 8 children froze to death. And since January 1st in Afghanistan, 26 children froze to death, 40 people, all told, have frozen to death. Now, how could children freeze to death? Well, it's because, you know, the parents might try to huddle everybody underneath blankets, but an infant can roll out from under the blanket, and the parents awake in the morning horrified and realize that their child has frozen to death. And in one family that I've gotten to know, the uncle of the family walked over to a 9-year-old girl. I was kind of huddled next to her to stay warm, really. And he unzipped the top of her jacket and pulled it back so that I would see there was no arm in the sleeve, because a drone attack had ripped off this young 9-year-old girl's arm. And next to her, her brother was just writhing in pain, and the same drone attack had mangled his leg. And then I read in the New York Times after I returned that their 8-month-old infant was among the children, the babies who'd frozen to death. So this is a family that's emblematic of intense, searing, horrible pain. And so many families have been affected. I talked to young Fadzilla, and now she's a widow, and she has a 5-year-old child, I know, to try to raise without a breadwinner, because her husband and 4 of his friends were sitting in a garden, and a drone attacked them and killed all 5. And her mother-in-law is so angry. She says they don't ask any questions. Who was this? Who was that? There's no evidence. Just they have some doubt or some suspicion. Right now, the United States is trying very hard to force Afghanistan's government to sign a strategic partnership agreement. And this would allow United States troops to remain in the country perhaps as long as 2024 or longer. And for young people in Afghanistan, I mean, I want to remind us all that the average life expectancy for women is 42.2 years of age. For men, it's 42.6 years of age. And 250 children die every day of starvation. 850 children die every day. So what can people expect who are young? 65% of Afghanistan's population are under 25 years of age. What can they expect for their future if the United States troops are going to stay there for another decade? Because the Taliban have made it very clear they'll never accept that. And they've broken off negotiations with the United States quite recently. And when the United States tries to say that the massacre of 16 people by a soldier who'd gone berserk is unusual, it's an aberration, that's not true. I mean, February 4th of just last month, a United States Combat Brigade unit helicopter executed, shot down four civilians who were shepherds on a mountainside. And on March 1st, eight children were executed because they were trying to graze their flocks on a mountainside. And this kind of thing happens routinely. The United States soldiers break into homes, and if anybody puts up any slight resistance, they can immediately be shot to death. So it's just not true to think that that was an extraordinary circumstance. People in Afghanistan have been bearing night raids and aerial bombardments and drone attacks almost as a norm throughout these horrible years of United States invasion and occupation.
Kathy, what do you make of the Obama administration's plan to withdraw troops from Afghanistan? There are 91,000 U.S. troops there now. There are 23,000 that are scheduled to be withdrawn by September and the rest by 2014. But as you mentioned earlier, there are negotiations right now over something called the U.S.-Afghanistan Strategic Partnership Agreement that would extend the U.S. presence beyond 2014. Maybe you can explain the nuance of that and what it really means in terms of the war going on well beyond 2014.
I don't think we should fool ourselves into thinking that although President Obama might say something that's popular during an election year about withdrawing the forces from Afghanistan, that in fact we're going to see an end to United States warfare in Afghanistan. That's why it's so important for people to debate and discuss this strategic partnership agreement. And it hasn't been debated in the U.S. media. It has certainly not been debated in the U.S. Congress. But this will have a tremendous impact on security for Afghanistan, for the region, and in some ways for the United States, because if we keep attacking innocent civilians in faraway lands, someday someone's going to say, hey, if you can attack us with your remote-controlled aircraft, we can attack you within your borders.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Learn more about her group's work in Afghanistan by visiting our website at btlonline.org. The conflict between protesters calling for the ouster of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and the military loyal to the regime continues to escalate. The shelling of cities and towns such as Homs, which has killed and injured hundreds, along with running battles between government troops and the opposition Free Syrian Army, is transforming what was once a civilian uprising into what many fear will lead to a full-scale civil war. One day before the first anniversary of the Syrian uprising on March 13th, a new Amnesty International report was released documenting the torture of protesters under President al-Assad. The report is based on interviews conducted with Syrians who fled to Jordan after being tortured or witnessing torture. Amnesty interviewed 25 individuals, and 19 of their testimonies appear in the report. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has accused some of Syria's armed rebel groups of committing serious abuses against captured members of the security forces. Thus far, the death toll from the current uprising is estimated at more than 8,000. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Susan Nossel, executive director of Amnesty International USA, who provides disturbing and graphic descriptions of several forms of torture. She says many of the torture techniques reported by victims and witnesses have not been seen in decades, although some had been used under the current president's father, Hafez al-Assad, who is charged with massacring more than 10,000 Syrians during his reign. Nossel also discusses the diplomatic actions Amnesty is calling for in order to end the repression and torture in Syria.
We've taken direct testimony from either people who are the victims of this torture or who witnessed this torture, who document an array of horrifying medieval practices that the Assad regime is using to torment dissenters, to threaten people, punish people, frighten people, and extend their clampdown on individuals who are in detention through the most brutal means.
Even though it's upsetting to hear, can you briefly enumerate some of these methods just so listeners have some idea of what's being done?
Sure. Flesh gouged out by pincers, people being hoisted up on a tire and being beaten on their feet and on their bodies, people being hung on hooks, people being strapped to a foldable wooden board, and then the two ends of the board are ratcheted toward each other, so the back is forced to bend almost into a V. And while this is happening, the person is beaten. Crucifixion, believe it or not, people being forced to watch the rape of other detainees, electric shocks, people, water being splashed on individuals and on the floor, and then an electric shock being applied so that it goes through the individual's body, reports of electric chairs being used, threatened rape, pushing a broken bottle into somebody's anus, so just an array of the most brutal and horrifying methods.
You spoke to 25 people. Do you have any idea how widespread this treatment is?
You know, it's hard to say because, of course, it's difficult for people to travel outside the country. Many people remain inside Syria, so it's very hard to make a judgment about how widespread these methods are. But the fact that, you know, we went into Jordan and were able to make contact with 25 people who documented these practices, you know, was significant.
Did most of the people you know about who were tortured survive, or do you know if many have died after torture?
People did report cases of other detainees witnessing deaths and killings of other detainees. One case, somebody spending the night with a corpse together in a cell. So there are cases of people dying in custody, yes.
Is there any indication that the armed opposition to Assad is conducting any of this kind of torture?
We have some reports of abuses committed by members of opposition groups, including abductions and some killings, people who were outspoken in their support for the government, and we're disturbed by that. We are documenting that, but it does not come close to the scale of the abuses and much less the torture that we've documented at the hands of the Assad regime.
Suzanne Nossel, there's been an attempt to pass a Security Council resolution condemning the violence by President Bashar al-Assad, which hasn't passed because Russia and China oppose it. Amnesty has called for stronger measures for Syria to be referred to the International Criminal Court, which in mid-March just delivered its first conviction since being founded in 2002. In the world of diplomacy, what do you think has to happen next?
You know, most important, of course, is for the Assad regime to end this brutal onslaught on its own people and to uphold respect for human rights, to hold those, including at the very top of the regime, who are responsible for these brutalities and these abuses, accountable. So the first obligation, is with them. We've seen action in the UN Human Rights Council and the UN General Assembly, but the place where action has been blocked is the UN Security Council, which is the foremost body charged with addressing matters of peace and security. And Russia and China have exerted their veto twice now to block action on Syria. And the net result is protection for the Assad regime, continued support for the regime, and the absence of the kind of concerted international pressure that would be necessary to generate change. So we're calling on China and Russia to shift their position, to come out in strong support of forceful UN Security Council action and a referral to the International Criminal Court. These new revelations brought to light of the, you know, medieval brutality and just calculated infliction of misery through this just draconian and really horrifying means, you know, hopefully that is enough to jostle those who've stood in the way of action to seeing the situation for what it is and coming out forcefully on the side of Syrians who are simply, in most cases, peacefully trying to exert their rights to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and their right to participate in their own governance.
That was Susan Nossel, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. Find links to the new Amnesty International report on torture in Syria and related articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The group Invisible Children's Stop Kony campaign, built around Kony 2012, a 30-minute video that has gone viral around the world, calls attention to the atrocities committed by Ugandan warlord Joseph Kony. Kony's brutal Lord's Resistance Army, which is engaged in conflicts in several nations in Central Africa, has abducted thousands of children to serve as child soldiers and sex slaves. The video, seen by as many as 80 million, targets young people and urges them to contact politicians and celebrities to call for intervention by the U.S. and other governments to arrest Kony, disarm his Lord's Resistance Army, and bring the child soldiers home. But Ugandans and others in the human rights community have leveled criticism at the Kony 2012 campaign for what they say is oversimplification of a complex set of issues in Central Africa. The film critics say mistakenly asserts that Kony's forces still operate in northern Uganda, when in fact his greatly diminished army is operating in sparsely populated areas straddling several borders outside of Uganda. The campaign advocates a military solution by way of U.S. aid to the Ugandan army, which itself has been accused of widespread human rights abuses, including massacres and torture of civilians, both inside Uganda and during cross-border invasions of the neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo. Your reporter spoke with Kambali Musavuli, national spokesperson and student coordinator with the group Friends of the Congo, who takes a critical look at Invisible Children's Kony 2012 video campaign.
Kony is a symptom of a larger problem. And the problem in Uganda is that there is an oppressive regime there that has been in power since 1986, supported by the United States since that time, and Uganda is a U.S. ally for the war on terror. So no matter what oppression they're doing in the country, it doesn't get into the press. So the video, Kony 2012, what it called for was a U.S. military intervention to catch Kony, but in support on an oppressive regime. And that has serious implications because of the history of the region. One is that the Ugandan government, with the Rwandan government, invaded the Congo twice, in 1996 and 1998, and they have unleashed the death of 6 million Congolese due to the scramble of Congo's minerals. They looted the gold, the coltan, the timber from the Congo, massacred civilians there while they had their troops in the Congo. And today we have peace activists, especially young Americans, believing that in order to end the conflict in Africa, you have to bring the U.S. military as a force of good. And the people of the region don't believe that's the way. That should not be an option because we've used that option already. And any time there have been military intervention, the population die. An example, in 2009, there was a U.S. military intervention there with the Ugandan military that caused the death of 1,000 people, yet Kony was not caught. So we know that the locals will suffer, and I hope as people discuss Kony 2012, they should ask themselves, what are the Ugandans saying is the solution to the country?
Kambali, have you or your group been in touch with the group Invisible Children, the group that produced this viral video, Kony 2012? And what do you think their motives are in terms of focusing on Joseph Kony and his atrocities and calling for intervention? Do you think they have any ulterior motives?
The ulterior motive will be speculation. I want to speak on fact. I do believe that Jason Russell and his team do want to address positively the situation in the Congo. I also believe that they are being misled about how to deal with the situation there. So what the listener needs to be clear on is, it's really not about invisible children. The United States has a policy, clear foreign policy, where they want to install the United States AFRICOM, the African Command, the U.S. military presence on the African continent. With or without invisible children, the United States will push for AFRICOM to be on the continent. And Kony is only the Trojan horse, allowing U.S. military presence on the continent under the guise of humanitarian intervention, while the greatest crimes It's not just corny. I hope the listeners can put this in the picture. In the Congo, more than 6 million people have died due to the crisis that's perpetrated by Uganda, the Ugandan government, and the Rwandan government. Today, we have 13-year-old American calling for U.S. military intervention to the oppressive regime, partly responsible for the deaths of 6 million human beings.
Tell us from your perspective what you believe the Pentagon here in the United States' objective is in terms of possible future interventions in conflicts in the continent of Africa and inserting the United States Africa Command squarely in the midst of these conflicts in Africa.
It's very clear for the Pentagon what they want for Africa. They have Dr. Burgess, who wrote a paper, Africa Strategic Minerals, already in 2010 at the U.S. Naval War College, where he said that the increased presence of China is concerning to America's interests in Africa. So it was clear that the United States military needed to use every tool in its disposal to counter Chinese presence in Africa to control resources that are essential to its military. I mean, think about this. Congo is the number one producer of cobalt. Cobalt is an essential mineral for U.S. military. The United States produces zero cobalt. So if you don't control Congo's cobalt, you can't have your drones flying over Iran. If you don't have Congo's cobalt, you can't have those jets have the flying over Afghanistan and dropping off precision targeted missiles. So if China is there and signed a contract, which they did, with the Congolese government are getting 600,000 tons of cobalt, the U.S. will use every power that they have to stop it. And they actually did. So and that's what the United States or the Pentagon's interest in Africa is right now.
That was Kambale Musavuli, national spokesperson and student coordinator with the group Friends of the Congo. Learn more about the issues raised in the CONI 2012 campaign by visiting our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.